This is continuing coverage of United States versus Sean Diddy Combs from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
It started with eggs, not metaphorically, actual eggs, a frying pan, a kitchen. What's been described as a burst of violence so jarring, it has stayed with the witness for over 15 years. That's how the morning unfolded in the federal courtroom on May 19th when Don Richard, former Danity Kane member, Bad Boy protege, and for a while a trusted part of Sean Combs' inner circle, took the stand and described what she says she saw. It wasn't hearsay, it wasn't secondhand, it was, in her words, up close, and it was ugly. Let me know in the comments what you think about this case, about the testimony today as we break down the trial of Sean Diddy Combs. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you may be listening to this or watching this so you don't miss any of our coverage, whether it be on the podcast platforms, on YouTube, on X, Twitter, wherever it may be. Let me know your thoughts on what is going on. Don Richard wasn't just another witness. She was someone who knew the rhythm of Diddy's world. Toured with him, built her name under his label, shared meals and maybe even dreams under the same roof. She was in the room when a lot of things went down. And on this particular day, she told the court about one she said she'll never forget. It happened in 2009. She said it started in the kitchen of Diddy's house with Cassie Ventura making breakfast, specifically eggs. Something about the way they were cooked apparently set Combs off. Richard described a furious outburst, shouting, violence, chaos. She told the jury she saw him try to hit Cassie with a frying pan, then actually hit her, drag her up a staircase, punch her, and kicked her in the stomach. This was the first moment when the courtroom collectively tensed for the day. It wasn't just the imagery, it was the weight of it coming from someone who had lived in that world, not as a victim, but as a witness. And then came the next piece. According to Richard, the following day, Combs called a meeting. She said it was brief and chilling. The message allegedly was clear. Keep your mouth shut. Don't talk about what happened. And everyone, she claimed, understood exactly what that meant. Now, the defense has been preparing for this. They knew Richard had filed her own civil lawsuit against Combs, claiming she was owed over $3 million in unpaid royalties. They also knew her story had evolved in some details over time. So when Combs' attorney, Nicole Westmoreland, got up for the cross-examination, she went straight for the weak points, or at least what she hoped were weak points. She brought up past interviews where Richard's recollection of that 2009 incident seemed different. In one account, Richard allegedly said Cassie got hit with the pan. In another, the detail was that Combs had thrown eggs, not the pan. She pointed out that Richard hadn't mentioned a gun in earlier conversations, but suddenly remembered one later. She also noted in a line in Richard's civil complaint something about Cassie hiding in a closet that didn't come up in court. Richard responded with a kind of blunt honesty that doesn't necessarily help your case, but can make you sound more credible. She said essentially, I wasn't asked that at the time. And when Westmoreland asked why certain details were included in a lawsuit but not in testimony, Richard said her lawyer had written the complaint, not her. She wasn't dodging so much as admitting the human fallibility of memory and process. At one point, Westmoreland tried to corner her on motivation. Wasn't this really about money, about revenge for a career that didn't go the way she'd hoped? Richard didn't flinch. She said, yes, financial compensation was part of the civil suit, but that didn't mean the abuse she saw didn't happen. And as for the career, she said she had no desire to work with Combs again, and she'd only reached out to reconnect with other former bandmates. There was no thirst for a reunion, no bitter ex-employee angle. She looked tired of the insinuation. That exhaustion, the kind of moral weariness, was maybe the most compelling thing about her testimony. She wasn't dramatic. She wasn't looking to perform. She wasn't crying. She told the court that some of her memories had come back more clearly over time. Every day it gets easier to remember certain things she said. There was something haunting in the way she said it, like trauma unspooling slowly but methodically. Now, one of the key legal questions was how much of her testimony would actually be allowed. Some of what Richard wanted to discuss, especially comments or threats that weren't directly witnessed, walked the tightrope of hearsay. Judge Aaron Samaranian, who's shown a sharp, almost professional control over these proceedings, allowed most of Richard's direct observations, but he made it clear that anything speculative or any secondhand retellings wouldn't make it in. The line he seems to be drawing throughout this trial is about reliability, not just what people feel or believe, but what they saw. In Richard's case, that meant the jury heard about the frying pan, the dragging, the next day warning meeting, but not much more. And really, that was enough, because what came through in Dawn Richard's testimony wasn't just an account of one violent outburst. It was the slow, painful collapse of trust, of loyalty, of the idea that keeping quiet helps everyone. Richard was part of the machine. She benefited from it. She was, at one point, proud of it. And then she said she saw something that broke that spell. What she described wasn't just violence. It was control, fear, silence, and the pressure to maintain the image at all costs. The defense will argue that memory is malleable, that stories evolve, that bitterness and money color everything. And maybe some of that will stick. But on this day, in this courtroom, what stuck was a very specific image. A woman making breakfast, a man allegedly snapping, and another woman standing a few feet away, realizing in that moment that the house she thought was a sanctuary might be something else entirely. Dawn Richard's story is now part of the official record. It's been entered into the bloodstream of the case, right alongside Cassie Ventura's own testimony, and it laid the foundation for what the rest of the day would bring. More voices from inside that world, each adding their own piece to the mosaic of control, coercion, and fear. And just after Richard stepped down, the court turned its attention to someone else, another witness who'd watched that world from a different angle, not from inside the industry, but from the perspective of someone who stood by Cassie for years, not on payroll, not under contract, just a friend with a front row seat. If Dawn Richard peeled back the curtain on the violence behind closed doors, Carrie Morgan and David James pulled you right into the architecture of control. The courtroom didn't just hear about trauma in the form of fists and frying pans this time. They heard about something more insidious, how someone with enough power, money, and influence doesn't have to lay hands on someone to trap them. They just have to build a system where leaving isn't an option. And according to Morgan and James, that's exactly what Sean Combs did. Carrie Morgan wasn't an employee. She didn't cash bad boy checks. She didn't work on tour buses. And she wasn't under contract. She was Cassie Ventura's friend, possibly one of the only people close to her who wasn't financially tied to Combs. And that distinction matters because when Morgan testified, she brought a perspective unfiltered by payroll loyalty or professional fear. She spoke as someone who watched her best friend disappear, bit by bit, into a life she says Cassie could not escape. Morgan told the court that by the time Cassie was deep into the relationship with Combs, everything about her life was under his thumb. Her music, he controlled it. Her apartment, his name was on it. Her income, he gave her an allowance. That word, allowance, it hit hard. Not salary, not partnership, allowance. Like a teenager in a house they didn't pay for. Morgan said Cassie often confided that she felt like she couldn't leave because leaving meant losing everything. Her home, her career, her safety net. You know, kind of like Scientology. And it wasn't just theoretical. Morgan walked the jury through multiple moments where she claims she witnessed Combs unleash his anger, both on Cassie and eventually on her. One incident that stuck out took place in Jamaica in 2013. Morgan said they were all staying in a villa and Cassie took too long in the bathroom. That's all it took. Morgan testified that Cassie's screams from the hallway weren't just loud, they were gut-wrenching, not normal panic, the kind of screaming, she said, that makes your body freeze. When she got to the hallway, she said she saw Combs dragging Cassie by her hair. Not yelling, not threatening, dragging. No security stepped in, not one. No one stopped it. Type of stuff you got away with. Another time, at a house in the Hollywood Hills, she said Combs pushed Cassie during an argument. Morgan thought he may have punched or kicked her too, but things were moving fast. She yelled at a security guard to do something. He refused. That part came up again and again and again. These men, these so-called protectors, standing around like statues, Morgan said. She helped Cassie run out of the house, and they hid behind a neighbor's steps while Combs and his bodyguard searched the area trying to find her. Then came the 2016 Intercontinental Hotel incident in Los Angeles. By now, the courtroom had already heard Cassie's account of that night. We've all seen the video. She said she was taken to one of Combs' infamous freak-offs, came back battered, black-eyed, barely functioning. Morgan confirmed it. She said Cassie came home wearing a hoodie, tried to hide her face, dropped her bags, and looked dazed, like she was barely present. Morgan said about 30 minutes later, Combs showed up at Cassie's place, screaming and pounding on the door with a hammer. Yes, a hammer! She said it looked like he was trying to break in. And when police arrived, Cassie wouldn't give them any information. She didn't show her ID. She didn't speak. Morgan said she was so far gone emotionally that, in her words, I don't think she cared if he came in and killed her. But it wasn't just Cassie who took the blows. In 2018, Morgan says Combs attacked her too. They were at Cassie's home and she was spiraling, jealous, paranoid. Morgan said he accused Cassie of cheating, then out of nowhere, he allegedly put Morgan in a chokehold. Not a shove, a chokehold. And then he threw a heavy wooden hanger at her head. It hit her behind the ear. She said she started vomiting. Her neck was marked. She had a concussion. Where was Cassie? Locked in the bathroom, refusing to come out. After that, Morgan was done, or at least she thought she was. A month later, she says Cassie met her at a pizza place in West Hollywood and offered her $30,000 to sign an NDA. Morgan took the money. She didn't try to sugarcoat it. She said she didn't know what else to do. But she also said it broke something between them. The friendship ended that day. They haven't spoken since. When Combs' attorney, Mark Agnifilo, got his turn, he tried to tug at the edges. He pointed out that Morgan had also witnessed tender moments between Combs and Cassie, as if that frickin' matters. Oh, but he loved her so much, too. Well, who cares about the stomping on her head and throwing the frying pan or whatever other crazy things he did? These tender moments. Tender love, throwing a coat hanger at your head, getting you in a chokehold. Baby, I surrender. That she'd traveled with them, enjoyed the perks, the Italy trips, the Burning Man festivals. He asked her if she told Cassie to stay with him. She admitted she had. Sometimes when things were good, she encouraged it. That's the thing about abusive dynamics. They're not black and white. They're gray. They oscillate. Agnifilo was trying to find those gray spots and make them stretch. But Morgan didn't flinch. No. She said those moments existed, sure. But they didn't erase what she saw, the bruises, the fear, the screams in Jamaica, the hammer in Los Angeles, the hanger that hit her head. Then came David James, Combs' former assistant. He had only a short time on the stand before court adjourned, but what he said reinforced Morgan's story from another angle entirely, the infrastructure behind the abuse itself. James worked directly for Combs. He was the guy behind the scenes making sure everything ran. And when he was hired, he said the head of HR pointed to a framed photo of Diddy on the wall and said, "This is Mr. Combs' kingdom. We're all here to serve in it." Kingdom, not company, not brand, kingdom. James described the level of micromanagement that defined Combs' world. Everything had to be just so. Hotels had to be stocked with specific items, rooms arranged in a certain way. There was a standard, and if you missed it, you were out. Consider yourself lucky if you got out. And during a smoke break with Cassie in Miami, James said she confided something that stuck with him. She looked around at the chaos of the tour life, the parties, the drugs, the control, and said, "Man, this lifestyle is crazy," James told her. "Then leave. Simple as that. But Cassie shook her head. I can't get out, she said. Mr. Combs oversees so much of my life, according to James. She told him that Combs managed her career, gave her an allowance, even controlled her living arrangements. She wasn't just trapped emotionally. She was trapped financially, logistically, structurally. One more ruling from Judge Aaron Semerinian quietly shaped the day's narrative. Prosecutors had wanted Morgan to testify about something Cassie allegedly said, that she didn't want to go to a freak-off but felt like she had to. The judge said no, that was hearsay. If Cassie said it, and she's not on the stand saying it right now, it doesn't come in. Semerinian was drawing a hard line. This case, he made clear, isn't about gossip. It's about what people saw, what they experienced firsthand. And by the end of the day, the court had heard from two very different people who both described the same thing. A woman surrounded by wealth, fame, lights, but isolated, silenced, and for all of her visibility, completely invisible. One had been her friend. One had been her handler, and both said they saw the same look in her eyes, like she was stuck in a place she could not escape. Tell me your thoughts on this day in the trial of Sean Diddy Combs in the comments on YouTube or X, Twitter, wherever you may be watching this. If you're listening to us on a podcast platform, thank you. Press subscribe wherever that may be. And also be sure to check us out on YouTube so you can comment on this stuff, or Twitter X at Tony B Pod on Twitter if you want to follow me there. Or just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi on YouTube. So you can find us there or on the podcast platform. If you're on YouTube right now going, oh, I would like to listen to this while I commute to and from every single day, you can do that. We got the podcast platforms for you as well, including a specific channel all about Diddy called The Downfall of Diddy. You can find that wherever you get podcasts. So let me know what your thoughts are. Another crazy day. This man needs to go away for the rest of his life. And by the looks of it so far, I think he's heading there. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for watching. We will talk again real soon.
If true crime is your obsession, we've got you covered. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today for nonstop coverage, expert insights, and in-depth analysis.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.